this week. I'm Steve Young, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Richard Nixon, considered by many to be the coldest of the cold warriors of the 1950s, came out of the cold this week, ironically, in communist China. Mr. Nixon has remained in almost unbroken seclusion at San Clemente since his 1974 resignation from the presidency after his Watergate disgrace. This week, Mr. Nixon returned to Peking on the fourth anniversary of his first historic journey. His reception there by the Chinese was warm, though more muted than 4 years ago, and it may be significant for several reasons, as CBS News reporter Barry Kalb explains from Peking.
To Richard Nixon, this trip is the coming out after 18 months of painful seclusion. To the Chinese, it's a chance to sound out a man they consider a friend on issues that are uppermost in their minds. And to America, it's a chance for some inside information on China's latest factional dispute. No matter how distasteful some Americans may find the idea of Richard Nixon again playing a public role. He's easing into the limelight slowly so far. Reporters covering his visit haven't been able to ask him a single question. But today he made his first public speech since his 1974 resignation. He stressed Sino-American friendship and the search for peace. It looks like he'd like to be making many more public speeches. The Chinese are taking him very seriously. He conferred with officials for over 3 hours today, most of the time with acting premier Hua Guofeng. Tomorrow he's scheduled for another session with Hua. Hua Guofeng, of course, is symbolic of the factional debate now raging here in China. He appears to be a compromise choice between the radicals and moderates. In his discussions with Hua, Mr. Nixon may be picking up some information on the dispute, and the American government now says it will request a report when he returns home. Richard Nixon is making himself useful to the Chinese, the Americans, and himself. Whether it will last beyond the end of this trip, nobody knows. Barry Kalb, CBS News, Peking.
Mr. Nixon's triumphant first visit to China saw him accompanied by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and other U.S. officials. This time, he and Mrs. Nixon were alone. And other than the Chinese, the only other diplomats present at the airport to greet him were the acting chief and another official of the U.S. liaison office. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is in the midst of a long-delayed trip to Latin America, as Frank Benitzis reports from Lima, Peru.
Venezuela proved cordial and correct. Peru was cooler, and the usual joint communique did not materialize in Lima. And on the third stop in a six-nation, nine-day trip to Latin America, Secretary of State Kissinger unveiled his major reason for the trip: to recognize Brazil as a world power and as the United States' closest Latin American ally. An agreement was signed yesterday in Brasilia by the two countries. Dr. Kissinger said, the pact provides that the United States will consult with Brazil, in his words, on all events of international significance. That placed Brazil on a level with Japan and its economic and political relations with the United States. The agreement aims at removing trade barriers and speeding up the transfer of American technology to Brazil. It was not clear what Brazil pledged to the United States. The move was not expected to help improve U.S. relations with the rest of the Southern Hemisphere as the two largest powers move forward openly in an economic and political alliance. Frank Menitzes for CBS News, Lima, Peru.
Congress remains unsettled on the issue of what sort of reforms are necessary for the CIA and the rest of the American intelligence community. President Ford stepped into the vacuum this week, proposing actions to prevent future abuses and establishing a new oversight committee of his own.
Henceforth, overall policy directions for intelligence will rest in only one place, the National Security Council, consisting of the President, the Vice President, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense. Management of intelligence will be conducted by a single new committee. That committee will be chaired by the Director of Central Intelligence, George Bush. To monitor the performance of our intelligence operations, I am creating a new independent oversight board to be made up of private citizens.
The chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Democrat Frank Church, considered the president's proposals inadequate.
The president's purpose is clearly to give the CIA a bigger shield and a longer sword with which to stab about, both within and without the country. But there's very little reform of the kind that is clearly required to protect the underlying liberties of the American people.
Church wants tough new laws to shore up freedom while still permitting intelligence agencies to do their work. The Senate Banking Committee this week wanted more information from Lockheed Aircraft Corporation concerning a business expense, bribes. The committee, under Chairman William Proxmire, is looking into allegations and admissions of payoffs to foreign officials.
All we're asking is that Lockheed say to whom they paid the money. I'm not saying that they have to go any farther. They do know that. They have records on it. They can disclose that. And once that fact is known, then the basis for determining who actually received a bribe is there. Otherwise, we won't know.
Once again, Great Britain is being asked to tighten its belt. Prime Minister Harold Wilson announcing this week a planned cut of more than $3.5 billion in the government's 1977-78 budget. Amazingly enough, considering the 30-year-old socialist policies of Wilson's Labour Party, the cuts all affect social welfare programs. From London, CBS News correspondent Bob Simon reports.
Try to imagine a fascist government calling for free elections or a communist government advocating private property. What actually happened in Britain would have been almost as difficult to imagine a few years ago. People living in low-rent housing developments, for example, will pay considerably higher rents when the legislation is passed. Food will cost more. Government subsidies have been cut on milk, bread, butter, cheese, flour, and tea. Train and bus fares will rise by some 50%. Parking charges will double. Dozens of hospitals will probably have to close. Many planned new ones will not be built. But the biggest cutbacks will be in education, meaning shabbier school buildings, stiffer competition for university places, and more expensive school meals. Reaction to the government's so-called white paper has been fairly predictable. The unions don't like it, neither does the Labour Party's left wing, which has called it a document of shame. The Conservatives, of course, say it's too little, too late. Bob Simon, CBS News, London.
This is the final weekend of campaigning before the New Hampshire presidential primary. CBS News correspondent Bill Plant points out that the outcome is important psychologically, not as a true sample of the nation's presidential preference.
New Hampshire's primary is important only because it is the first. Important to the country's first appointed president, seeking his first mandate outside Michigan. Gerald Ford made his second campaign trip here late in the week. Important, too, to Ford's challenger Ronald Reagan, a skillful politician. Both camps are hedging their bets, saying the outcome is likely to be too close for the winner to claim real victory. If the Republican contest is a clear-cut confrontation, the Democratic battle is a muddle. There are five major candidates, not one of whom has previously enjoyed great national recognition, all seeking credibility as presidential material more than anything else. Former Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter, alone here as a right-of-center entry, is believed to be the front-runner. But right behind Carter is the so-called liberal pack, Morris Udall, Birch Bayh, Sergeant Shriver, and Fred Harris, each of whom seeks to become the party's new liberal standard-bearer and earn the right to take on Carter, Jackson, and Wallace in primaries to come. Udall seems to have the most effective organization. Bayh and Harris each have substantial help. Shriver progress has been less visible. To further complicate matters, there is a slate of Jackson delegates, though he is not on the ballot, and unauthorized write-in campaigns for Hubert Humphrey and John Connolly. The candidates maintain that perhaps as many as 40% of Democratic voters were undecided at week's end. And those are the voters who will decide which of the prospective nominees is to survive. Bill Plant, CBS News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
And that's The World This Week, produced by Harry Poloshin. This is Steve Young, CBS News.